Welcome, everyone, to the Pop Culture Podcast by Fantastic Geek. Today, we're talking Star Trek Into Darkness. By the way, I neglected to introduce myself. I'm called John Harrison, but my real name is Matt.
I see what you did there. That was mysterious.
Now, Matt, I think we should caution our listeners right now. If you don't get that joke, stop, because we're going full spoilers here, and there's a lot to be spoiled, so make sure that you've come back.
We've got spoilers hanging out all over the place here.
Indeed.
With that in mind, so we'll come out swinging. Tidbit learned, Matt, after we saw the fan sneak of Star Trek Into Darkness at 8 o'clock in IMAX 3D just last night. Did you know that so much as onto the set, the character's name was Erickson, and they cheated the audio to make it Harrison? Erickson, of course, being the original name in Space Seed on the draft script for Khan Noonien Singh's character. There is in Space Seed, which I watched in the last week, I'm spoiler Pete, we'll go into that in a little bit, but rewatched in the last week, and there is an Erickson specifically referenced, so they at least kept that name. But interesting to know that they shot with that name. Your thoughts, Matt?
Wow, I did not know that. I mean, I had heard the early, 2 years ago, the rumor, oh, it's going to be Khan. But I think at that point, nobody really had a sense. I don't want to say I didn't see it coming. I mean, it was one possibility of a finite number of possibilities. I was fully surprised when he fessed up to being Khan. I did not see it coming. I take that back. The blood bit, which is introduced so early on, the fact that he has super blood, the fact there are a couple hints here and there about him being so smart. Obviously, he doesn't get, he doesn't take a beating. It was in the back of my head as this, maybe they're redoing, maybe it's a, kind of a hint towards Space Seed, or it's a misdirect or that kind of thing. I certainly was appropriately blown away when the announcement, well, when he announced that his name was Khan.
I have known pretty definitively for about a year that it was going to be Khan through some things that came out very late in the production when they were filming last year. The scenario that was painted for me was essentially, okay, we're going to mash together the idea of a Bin Laden-esque character. At the same time, we're going to take the concept of a SEAL Team 6 and we're going to throw them in a blender. What if the Federation, either through Spock Prime, the Leonard Nimoy Spock's cooperation, found Khan and unfroze him and weaponized him for good, or they wound up using him and he went against what they had done, using, of course, his crew, his people, what he calls in the film, which is a film essentially about family and brotherhood, his family against him.
Well, I don't know. We've talked before about the pros and cons, no pun intended. I'll avoid that.
Cons!
About, spoiler versus not spoiler. I think that the one legitimate criticism I heard about the first movie was, hey, it's a great, reboot, great return to these characters, but what is it really about? So many Star Trek episodes are about, racism or gender roles or, so on and so forth, that is capturing its time, whether it's the 60s, to a lesser degree the 70s, because it's obviously only the animated series in one movie. But, things like in Next Generation, you have, Worf the Klingon, who's on the Enterprise, that's imagining that one day maybe the USSR won't be our mortal enemy, so on and so forth. All these times where it's looked forward to a better future while commenting on our present future. That was not there in the first movie. And boy, this movie is about the world that we've lived in the last 10, 12 years.
I have to set you back just one moment on the original. I think the original is about something. And Matt, as a, not to say, well, let's put it this way. You're never really going to know my politics, Internet. But Matt, as a card-carrying Obama supporter, the last film is very much about Obama's, you know, promise and the promise of a new day and how things, even though it's filmed before, you know, they definitely seized on that zeitgeist and really went forward with that. So I have to disagree that the first film is not essentially about anything. I do think it's about something. It's about hope.
Okay. Hey, Pete, you're a hope and change kind of guy. So
well, as much as you are.
I guess just to kind of jump around a bit here, I thought the opening scene really, really fun in a movie that is advertising itself up front as taking you to a darker place than Star Trek normally goes. It was nice to kind of have that James Bond pre-credit sequence. They're wrapping up just an old-fashioned Star Trek adventure where they're trying to do the right thing. There's all sorts of hijinks. Watch out for the spear-throwing natives. Boy, you just escape just in time. You bend the Prime Directive. You break the Prime Directive. Everybody gets out okay. You know, all was missing was, you know, one more scene on the bridge where it's just like Yeoman Rand brings Kirk coffee and they all have a nice forced laugh while it says, you know, producer Robert Justman, executive producer Gene Roddenberry, and you cut to the, you know, cut to an external shot of the ship and you head to commercial. So a lot of fun there in the opening scene.
I thought it was pitch perfect. We were lucky enough, thanks to the gift of the internet in December, to not have to pay to see The Hobbit, to see that. And, you know, they recut what we originally saw. And, you know, listeners of the podcast, and new ones, of course, can go back and listen to our initial impressions. You know, flipping the order of what they had from the London subplot early on to dropping us right in James Bond style is the perfect way to describe it. Unlike many James Bonds, however, you know, what is established in this prologue is the soul of the movie. This is a love story between two friends. And it's established right off the bat. It is beautifully handled in that prologue. Again, it's pitch perfect. The Prime Directive is a story point to be bent however you need it to be in order to tell the story that you want. And they do that wonderfully here. There are thrills, there are chills in the volcano. You know, Spock is fine in that, you know, he's you know, complaining that Kirk has broken the Prime Directive, and really well handled dissolve from the natives that just watched a starship rise out of their ocean. You know, sketching it on the ground to, you know, the Enterprise ready to head to warp, and we're right back with old friends 6 months in their time, 4 years in our time later. And I just want to make one point about the time passage. Please get it together and get this next one out for 2016. I know we've got the whole JJ going to do Star Wars and everything, and, you know, listen, you're not going to find a bigger Star Wars guy than me. I like to think I'm a really, really big Trek guy too. Star Wars is always going to be my first love, but let's turn this around for the 50th anniversary, please. But to consider that in a 4 year period, in 1982, we get the Wrath of Khan. In 1984, we get the Search for Spock. In 1986, we get the Voyage Home, arguably the backbone, not even arguably, definitively the backbone of that original run. To think that we would have had those three movies in the time it's taken them to crank out two. And again, it's quality. I'm not going to argue that, you know, what we got last night was in any way rushed or anything like that. You just want more of it. And given where we leave off at the end of this one with the promise of a 5-year mission that is initially denied because of their actions on the Class M Nibiru. I'm really giddy at the prospects of where they're going to go.
Pete, let's keep jumping around a little bit. This movie saw the official non-deleted scenes introduction of the helmeted Klingons. Then that helmet comes off. I mean, what did you think of the Klingon ships, the actual Klingon makeup, and their relatively short time but fun time in the film?
Again, I think they bend enough to suit their premises. I know that you know, one of the writers, Bob Orkey, his whole raison d'etre with this, his uncle is a huge Trekkie, and he writes these in a way that he's not going to anger his uncle, and he's going to honor, you know, nearly 50 years of canon that's come before. You mentioned the Klingons. You know, I don't look at it so much that we had, you know, the finest of the Klingon Empire in the scene that took place there, but more so like that was a patrol. Like those were basically Klingon cops, maybe Keystone Klingon cops, the way that Khan carved them up. And I really like, too, that, you know, if you're going to give us Khan, and, you know, we'll come back to the point in a little bit as far as making that choice, because they went the Joker route here. It was too big of a character to not play with. But if you're going to give us Khan, you've got to do some things differently. It can't be the same thing. And we never, ever, actually, with rare exception, when he lifts a beam off of, you know, Joachim in The Wrath of Khan, that's the only time we really get at his superior strength. And we saw what a badass Khan Noonien Singh physically could really be in his prime in this film.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit in Space Seed where he's kicking butt for a while, but yeah, certainly not the
Kirk hits him with like a paper towel roller that he pulls out from the engine room.
I was happy. The Klingon makeup was different enough.
Yes.
But also, you kind of can't. It obviously wasn't the difference between Classic Trek and motion picture. It wasn't as big a difference between motion picture and Next Generation. Even during the course of Next Generation, Worf's makeup gets better. Next Generation, Deep Space Nine. It was different enough, while I think not really stepping outside canon. You know, you've seen so many different types of the Klingon ridge. The fact that this guy had no hair and kind of the ridge piercings, I almost called it nose piercings, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It totally fit in with like, yeah, this was totally the biker gang Klingon cop style that could perfectly fit into some of the other Klingons that we've seen, even though those were made for TV.
I felt they played him a little lizard-esque too, and I really got a Enemy Mine vibe both from the makeup and a little bit of the body language.
I did not get a lizard vibe, but I'm usually not a repeat return to the movie person, because I less and less like going to the movies. I'd rather watch at home. This might be one that I see again, so that's certainly something I could keep an eye out for.
Well, I'm going again tomorrow, so open invite.
Wow, exciting times. Pete, let's move on to what I think the movie means to have at its heart, particularly given the little comment made after the credits. The notion that we're kind of in this, you know, that the movie's about terrorism post 9/11, 9/11 itself. I'll kind of give you a starting point here. The New York Times review by A.O. Scott chided the movie for being too militaristic. I know I have a really strong reaction towards that claim by the vaunted Mr. Scott, but hey, no pun intended either. But what do you think about Mr. Scott's words in the New York Times that the movie's just glorifying militarism?
I think that Mr. Scott is the finest engineer in Starfleet, and I really believe that his place is on the Enterprise. But to talk about the reviewer from the Gray Lady there, the New York Times, again, I don't know if sometimes we watch the same films. This film is completely anti-military in terms of the amount of violence that happens. This universe has been rebooted. Things are happening at breakneck pace. There's advancements being used militarily that really the banging of the war drums is to explain that we're moving too quickly. It shouldn't be this way, but they have this technology and they're going to use it. And the creation of the Vengeance and the unleashing of Khan, all these things are as a result of it. There's still a very light and tender aspect to this. This is not the Dark Knight, nor should it be played as such. But it's Star Trek's version of it. And it's this movie is about big ideas. I think first and foremost, the friendship, but secondly, it was this idea of the military buildup and the overdoing of such techniques.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, all Kirk wants is the 5-year mission to go out and learn new things about space and come back 5 years later. That's what they get at the end. And in the middle, the opposite of that is happening, and they're trying to avoid that. It's the constant thing of the Enterprise's weapons. You know, let's say particularly in classic Trek, you know, they'll come across some superior alien that'll say, "Oh, you have weapons," and they'll say, "These are weapons that are for defensive purposes only, for our protection," to so on and so forth. I mean, this is a movie. I think it's two-sided. It's fair in the take of basically saying, and here they are kind of with 9/11 and post-9/11 iconography. It's fair in saying, hey, we need to prepare because the other side is preparing too. You know?
And a month after the Boston Marathon, okay?
Yeah.
Between Iron Man, between this, and I got a little worried, after a bombing, knowing that, how big bombings figure into both stories, wondering if we were going to get like happened instantly after September 11, 2001, where, okay, you can't show Die Hard on TBS, get Nanny 911 tapes out or whatever they're going to throw you. That's, we can chuckle and be lighthearted. There wasn't any fear by these production companies. I think these projects were both so far down the pipe, there was no way you would ever be able to do that. But to come back to our Scots, both Montgomery and AO, Mr. Scott is the one to explain, to point this out. I thought we were explorers. You're putting these torpedoes on here. This isn't what we're about. I'm not signing off on this. And, I'm not signing off on A.O. Scott's review, as much as I love his work, that this is a movie about militarism. It's the converse of that.
Yeah, I mean, this, for all the action in the movie, there's this undercurrent where I know Kirk is named captain at the end of the last movie. I think that it's not just a dramatic conceit, but it's thematically telling that he gets that captaincy taken away and then is made Captain Kirk by the end of the movie. Well, yeah, I mean, shortly after the attack, but he is made Captain Kirk anew. What's the thematic purpose of that? He's ready to just run and gun as necessary, which is the Captain Kirk that we know. But, the William Shatner Captain Kirk is somebody who's tempered by wisdom most of the time. Some of that is kind of that 1960s, hey, we're America, of course we're going to do the right thing. If we, whatever it is we do, it's going to be the right thing. But the fact that he's being told by Spock, by Scotty, by Carol Marcus.
Mm-hmm.
These
Carol
are people,
Wallace Marcus.
Indeed. These are all people that are whispering in his ear saying there's a better way than this. Run and gun is not the way to do this. There's a higher calling here. And at the end of the movie, he gets what he wants, which is to not be militaristic. He gets what's in his soul and his instinct to not be militaristic, to be that explorer who can use force when necessary. But I mean, insofar as Captain Kirk is this icon of America, America at its best, or America as we understand it at its best at any given time, the fact that he rejects this militarism. I mean, it would have been so easy to just hear from Admiral Marcus, here's the deal. The Klingons are arming too. We have a big giant gunship. They probably have a big giant gunship too. We need parity, which would have tied really nicely into, you know, the truth behind the atomic bomb arms race between this country and the USSR. There was no atomic war, in part because both sides were, you know, had mutually assured destruction. Admiral Marcus is the bad guy in this movie in large part, and he's arguing for that kind of parity, which can lead to peace, but we know that's not the best that we can do.
Right. I mean, on Marcus there, and I think we've said everything we need to about that review and about that theme in the film. I know we talked a little bit last night about Peter Weller as a choice, and yes, he's certainly got the chops to, you know, inhabit a role like this and essentially be the heavy, you know, Khan is being Khan. You can't take away who he is, and we'll come back to that in a moment, as much as he might try to con you that he's not. But the idea here that Peter Weller, I mean, what was the last big thing he was in? He's RoboCop, he's Buckaroo Banzai, you know, he's in Leviathan. It's been a long time since he had a role like this. I certainly appreciated him playing this role, but I know we were kind of raising our eyebrows at that a little bit.
I thought he was a welcome presence. I mean, he has that, he should be, whatever age the Admiral Marcus is, he should be that age. The fact that he can go from hero with ribbons on my coat to the guy he ends up, which is negative without being a black-hatted villain, you know, it requires an actor who can do that. And Peter Weller did it.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I just feel, you know, it felt a little bit out of left field. You definitely felt the, you know, when he becomes the replacement surrogate father, you know, the double surrogate father after, you know, Admiral Pike is killed in Khan's second attack. You know, I think they really kind of smacked us up the head with the use of the word son towards Kirk several yeah. times in this film. Felt a little forced. But I think the choice was kind of bland. You know, he's got the gravitas, but at the same time, I think you might have gone a little bigger. I think the other concern was, did you want somebody to overshadow Cumberbatch? Which, you know, let's be honest, the guy is poised on the precipice of international stardom.
Yeah, yeah. Pete, as we kind of head towards wrapping things up, I guess we'll kind of move into a potpourri phase, little bits and pieces here and there. I'll just mention one quick thing. I loved the attention to detail in Marcus's office room, for lack of a better word. There was this line of what I think we're meant to recognize as previous Enterprises. It's probably just kind of meant to be, in general, the evolution of the fleet. But right. You have the Space Shuttle Enterprise. You have the Phoenix from Star mm-hmm. Trek First Contact. You have Captain Archer's Enterprise from Star Trek Enterprise, so on and so forth, each one getting bigger and bigger, kind of echoing the wall of the conference room in Next Generation. So
Don't
really nice touch there.
Don't leave out the Vengeance. They showed us the bad guy ship before we even knew what it was.
Indeed. That was a good catch on your part.
So I'm going to talk a little bit quickly about the decision to go with Khan here. And, you know, it's been an open secret for the last couple of weeks since the film had screened. And I think the temptation was too much for the writers to not go with. The rumored post-credit scene that they talked about for the first movie was to see the Botany Bay, you know, floating quietly in space. It's out there. It's going to get found. You know what's coming next. They backed off of that. I think it was to their advantage.
Yeah.
Whatever they considered for the threat for this film, Khan had to be in the mix. And they have very much fallen back on the Batman Begins trilogy cycle idea here as a model for this, right down to the fact that we've gotten, you know, an IMAX preview this time around. Where else have we seen that before? Okay, they're going right out of that playbook. It was too big of a obstacle and a benefit for them not to go with Khan. And I think they handled it very well. He's the Joker. And if you think you're going to get one crack, another crack at this and not use him, I can't fault them in the least for going with him here. I know the fan base, there's a little bit of controversy. I thought I was going to have a bigger issue with, but wait, he's British and Lily White. He's not a Northern Indian. He's not a Hispanic gentleman playing a Northern Indian. And we know that Benicio del Toro was in the contract talks to initially play this role. I'm glad they went with Cumberbatch. Again, I think that you go younger rather than older. It's a better foil for Kirk. I think entire portions of the movie might have needed to be rewritten if they had a bigger age difference between the two. There's the idea of them working together. There's the idea of them, you know, being the shadow. And now that, you know, Kirk has Khan blood in him, what that portends for the future in terms of his abilities is going to be interesting to see. What I don't like about The Dark Knight in that Heath Ledger was dead and they made the conscious decision after the actor's death to keep the character of the Joker alive and then not come back to him in the third film. I really like that they kept the Star Trek Joker, that they kept Khan alive here. Will he be in the third one? I'd have to say no at this point. But you keep him on the table. We're, you know, 17 to however many years ahead of pace in that this was a mirror in many parts of The Wrath of Khan. But there are things that have already happened that happen in the five-year mission. Bones specifically mentions, you know, performing a C-section on a Gorn for octuplets. So it's all hands on deck for the next one.
Speaking of some of the mirroring of Star Trek II, it took me a while to digest my feelings as to whether, you know, the Kirk death scene, now, you know, in place of the Spock death scene from Wrath of Khan, some of the same dialogue being there, Spock yelling Khan. Initially, I was not happy with that. As we were driving home, as I was thinking about it, you know, going to bed, thinking about it today, you know what? I dig it. I like that they're, first of all, they've said that they're not making Star Trek movies for Star Trek fans. They're making Star Trek movies for many people to go see. So how many people are going to look at that and go like, oh, they're doing more than a wink to the audience. They're doing a full on nod. They've taken dialogue from Star Trek II. A lot won't. And you know what? That's okay. That could be something that they could, when new fans go and check out Wrath of Khan, they'll have this moment of like, oh man, this is like from the other one, but the other one's from this. And it's going to be a nice mental discussion to have. And I ended up digging it. I really did.
And, it wasn't a ripoff. It was an homage. And I think they're different. Like you said, you know, wink, nod. How do you do something different if that's what you're going to do?
Yeah.
You have to do it and you flip it around. And, you know, is this the mirror universe? It's not. But is this the mirror universe? I think it is.
All I know is that the Shatner Kirk, and I don't mean to suggest the Kirk portrayed by William Shatner, that, you know, that William Shatner would have impacted this, but the prime universe Kirk would not have gone into that engine room to make that sacrifice.
Oh, I could not disagree more. Matt, I'm sorry. You're dead wrong. Speaking as someone who wrote his college application essay on James Tiberius Kirk, he would have done anything to lay down his life for his friend. Here, he got the opportunity for the first time, whereas Spock took it from him before.
Fair enough. I suppose a point upon which we disagree, but that's what makes our time to be able to sit down and chat about these things so much fun.
I'll still be your friend.
Excellent. I have been and ever shall be yours. With that, Pete, let's just take literally 30 seconds. Let's look ahead. I believe our next podcast is going to be our reflections after we visit the always interesting Philadelphia Comic-Con. Am I correct?
Yes, and there will be all sorts of Trek celebs, both major and minor, there. Last year we had all of the captains. I have not glanced too heavily at the guest list this year, but there's always the regulars. So we'll get them. We'll get all our Marvel Universe folk. We'll get all sorts of people in between. Should be a good time. What are we going to hit after that?
After that probably would be Man of Steel, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's good stuff. And sprinkled in between as we record episodes of our S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast, that'll be simulcast, simul-released on the Pop Culture podcast feed as well. So definitely a busy summer of movies, conventions, looking back at some of the Marvel movies. A lot going on in the old Pop Culture podcast.
For show.
With that, Pete, I will bid everyone a live long and prosper, and as is the habit, I will give you the final word.
I'm going to go with the other generation, but I'm going to say, make it so.